I'm Viv Sutherland. Welcome to the Lesbian Radio Show. Today we have a reading from the 13th Moon series, which was produced by Ellen Marie Bissert. The reader is Audre Lorde. This is Ellen Marie Bissert introducing the reading.
It is always an honor to welcome Audre Lorde. In political communities of evolving priorities, Audre Lorde has always been herself, black, lesbian, feminist poet, for over a decade. I think that is what I most admire, a resolute consciousness of self without apology or compromise. Audre is the author of several books of poetry, New York Head Shop and Museum, Between Ourselves, Black Unicorn, and From a Land Where Other People Live, which was nominated for a National Book Award in 1974. She has also written essays that have appeared in Black Scholar, Chrysalis, Ms. Magazine, and Sinister Wisdom. At present, she just completed her first biomythography, I've Been Standing on the Street Corner a Hell of a Long Time. In her cancer journals, just selected by the Gay Caucus of the American Library Association, she writes, "My silences had not protected me. Your silence will not protect you." In confronting the terror of breast cancer, Audre breaks through our muteness, our oppression, the lies we whisper to ourselves. Please welcome Audre Lorde, a former resident of Washington Heights.
Thank you. I'm looking for the green ribbons. It's something that registers in my head, and I've been traveling a lot in the last couple of months and been struck by how easily we forget, how easy it is to believe, for instance, that the murders of black children in Atlanta, the murders and disappearances of black people all over this country is something that belongs to other people. The first poem I'm going to read this afternoon is a poem which is dedicated to the children who are dead in Atlanta and Newark and all over this country, and even more importantly, to those children who are still living. And the title of it is Zaki Tan Ke Parle Lot. Zaki Tan Ke Parle Lot is a phrase which is called through the streets of Karakou, which is a West Indian island off the coast of Grenada. It means, "Oh, you who hear, tell the others." And it's in patois. Zaki tan ke parle lot. Oh, zaki tan ke parle lot. Oh, you who hear, tell the others. There is no metaphor for blood flowing from children. These are your deaths or your judgment. Zaki tan ke parle lot. You who hear, tell the others. This is not some other city's trial. Your locks are no protection. Hate chips your front doors like flint, flames creeping beneath them. My children rest in question, and your tomorrows flicker. A face without eyes, Zaki tan ke parle lot, whose visions lie dead in the alleys, dreams bagged like old leaves, all our angers shorn of promise. You are drowning in my children's blood without metaphor. Oh, you who hear, tell the others. Zaki tan Kay Parlay Lot. Zaki Tan, Kay Parlay Lot. I'm working on a new set of poems, the overall title of which will be Poems for Women in Rage, or at least that's the working title. And one of them isn't called After Images. This is the poem I'm about to read. I am always very, very conscious of the ways in which we internalize our images, where we get them from, how they cook inside of us and do not go away, and how so frequently, because now we talk about those fractures, those gulps between black women and white women, and how we handle them and what we do not attend to, and they are many, and we carry them around inside of ourselves, and to ignore them will mean disaster. And this poem is about some of them. For instance, how many of you here remember the name Emmett Till? After Images. However the image enters, its force remains. My eyes are rock-strewn caves where dragonfish evolve, wild for life, relentless and acquisitive, learning to survive where there is no food. My eyes are always hungry and remembering. However the image enters, its force remains. A white woman stands bereft and empty, a black boy hacked into a murderous lesson, both recalled in me forever, like a lurch of earth on the edge of sleep, etched into my visions, food for dragonfish that learn to live upon whatever they must eat, the fused images beneath my pain. The Pearl River floods through the streets of Jackson, a Mississippi summer televised. Trapped houses kneel like sinners in the rain. A white woman climbs from her roof to a passing boat. Her fingers tarry for a moment on the chimney, now awash. Tearless, no longer young, she holds a tattered baby's blanket in her arms. In the flickering afterimage of a nightmare rain, the microphone thrust up against her flat, bewildered words. We just come from the bank yesterday, borrowing money to pay the income tax. Now everything is gone. I never knew it could be so hard. Despair weighs down her voice like Pearl River mud caked around the edges. Her pale eyes scan the camera for help or explanation. Unanswered, she shifts the search across a watered street. Dry-eyed, she says, hard, but not this hard. Two tow-headed children hurl themselves against her, hanging upon her coat like mirrors, until a man with ham-like hands pulls her aside, snarling, she ain't got nothing more to say. And that lie hangs in his mouth like a shred of rotting meat. Part 3. I inherited Jackson, Mississippi. For my majority, it gave me Emmett Till, his 15 years puffed out like bruises on plump boy cheeks, his only Mississippi summer. Whistling a 21-gun salute to Dixie while a white girl passed him in the street, and he was baptized my son forever in the midnight waters of the Pearl. His broken body is the afterimage of my 21st year, when I walked through this northern city, my eyes averted from each corner's photographies, newspapers, protest posters, magazines, police story, confidential, true, the avid insistence of detail, pretending insight or information, the length of gas across the dead boy's loins, his grieving mother's lamentations, the severed lips, how many burns his gouged out eyes sewed shut upon the screaming covers louder than life. All over the veiled warning, the secret relish of a black child's mutilated body, fingered by street corner eyes, bruise upon livid bruise. And wherever I looked that summer, I learned to be at home with children's blood, with savored violence, with pictures of black, broken flesh, used, crumpled, and discarded, lying amid the sidewalk refuse like a raped woman's face. A black boy from Chicago whistled on the streets of Jackson, tested what he'd been taught was a manly thing to do. His teachers ripped out his eyes, his sex, his tongue, and flung him to the pearl, weighted with stone, in the name of white womanhood. They took their aroused honor back to Jackson and celebrated in a whorehouse the double rituals of white manhood confirmed. Part 4. If earth and air and water do not judge them, who am I to refuse a crust of bread? Emmett Till rides the crest of the Pearl River whistling. 24 years his ghost lay like the shade of a raped woman, and a white girl has grown older in costly honor. What did she pay to never know the price? Now the Pearl River speaks its muddy judgment, and I can withhold my pity and my bread. Hard, she says, but not this hard. Her face is flat with resignation and despair, with ancient and familiar sorrows, a woman surveying her crumpled future as the white girl besmirched by Emmett's whistle, never allowed her own tongue, without power or conclusion. Unvoiced, she stands adrift in the ruins of her honor, and a man with an executioner's face pulls her away. Within my eyes, the flickering afterimage of a nightmare reign. A woman wrings her hands beneath the weight of agonies remembered. I wade through summer ghosts, betrayed by vision, hers and my own, becoming dragonfish to survive the horrors we are living, with tortured lungs adapting to breathe blood. A woman measures her life's damage. My eyes are caves, chunks of etched rock, tied to the ghost of a black boy, whistling, crying, and frightened. Her tow-headed children cluster like little mirrors of despair, their father's hands upon them, and soundlessly a woman begins to weep. Winnie Mandela is
South African freedom fighter. She is now exiled in South Africa with her youngest daughter, Zinzi, who is a poet. And I could ask how many of you know her name or Zinzi's name. The fact that we don't, of course, is a comment about how we get our information and what happens when we only listen to the 6 o'clock and the 11 o'clock news. Right? And this poem comes out of that that consciousness, and I guess it is, again, a plea for each one of you here to recognize what a responsibility we all have for acquiring information about what is going on in our world, because it is never going to be given to you on the 6 o'clock news. The title of this is The Evening News, and the beginning and end refrains are things that were presented in a series on how to save one's life. This is called The Evening News. First rule of the road: attend quiet victims first. That's what it said. I'm really glad you appreciate that. I'll run that one through again. That is, in fact, what it says, and there is a set of rules for what you do. First rule of the road: attend quiet victims first. I am kneading my bread, Winnie Mandela. The children who sing in the streets of Soweto are jailed for inciting to riot. The moon in Soweto is mad, is bleeding my sister into the earth, is mixing her seed with the vultures. Greeks reap her like olives out of the trees. She is skimmed like salt from the skin of a hungry desert. While the Gambier fisherwomen with milk-large breasts hide a fish with the face of a small girl in the prow of their boats. Winnie Mandela, I am feeling your face with the pain of my crippled fingers. Our children are escaping their birth in the streets of Soweto and Brooklyn. What does it mean, our children, our wars being fought by our children? Winnie Mandela, our names are like olives, salt, sand, like the opal, amber, obsidian that hides their shape well. We have never touched shaven foreheads together. Yet how many of our sisters, our daughters' bones, whiten in secret, whose names we have not yet spoken, whose names we have never spoken? I have never heard their names spoken. Second rule of the road: any wound will stop bleeding if you press down hard enough. I'm going to end the first set with one of the poems, Woman in Rage. This is a particularly West Side poem. It was conceived there. It happened there. Here, a poem for women in rage. A killing summer heat wraps up this city, emptied of all who are not bound to stay. A black woman waits for a white woman, leans against the railing in an Upper West Side street. The distant sounds of Broadway dim to lulling until I can hear the voice of sparrows. Like a promise, I await the woman I love, our slice of time, a place beyond the city's pain. In the corner phone booth, a woman, glassed in by reflections of the street between us, her white face
dangles like a tapestry of disasters through a veneer of order, her mouth drawn like an ill-used roadmap to eyes without core, the bottled heart, impeccable credentials of old pain. The veneer cracks. Hate launches through the glaze into my afternoon. Our eyes cross like hot wire, and the street snaps into nightmare. A woman with white eyes is clutching a bottle of Fleischmann's gin, is fumbling at her waistband, is pulling a butcher knife from her ragged pants. Her hand arcs backward, "You black bitch!" The heavy blade sings out toward me, slow motion. Years of fury surge upward like a wall. I do not hear it clatter to the pavement at my feet. A gear of ancient nightmare turns swift in familiar dread and silence, except this time I am awake, released. I smile. Now, this time, it is my turn. I bend to touch the knife, my ears blood drumming. Across the street, my lover's voice, the only moving sound within white heat. Don't touch it. I straighten, weaken, then start down again. Hungry for resolution, simple as anger and so close at hand. My fingers reach for the familiar blade, the known grip of wood against my palm, for I have held this to the whetstone 1,000 nights for this, escorting fury through my sleep like a cherished friend, to wake in the stink of rage beside the sleep-white face of love. The keen steel of a dreamt knife sparks honed from the whetted edge with a tortured shriek between my lover's voice and the gray spinning. A choice of pain or fury slashing across judgment like a crimson scar. I could open her up to my anger with a point sharpened upon love. And in the deathland, my lover's voice fades like the roar of a train derailed on the other side of a river. Every white woman's face I love and distrust is upon it, eating green grapes from a paper bag, marking yellow exam books tucked into a manila folder, orderly as the last thought. Before death, I throw the switch. Through the screams of crumpled steel, I search the wreckage for a ticket of hatred, my lover's voice calling a knife at her throat. In this steaming aisle of the dead, I am weeping to learn the names of these streets my feet have worn thin with running, and why they will never serve me nor ever lead me home. Don't touch it, she cries. I straighten myself in confusion. A drunken woman is running away down a west side street. My lover's voice moves to a shadowy clearing. And I refuse to become my own nightmares. Corralled in fantasy, the woman with white eyes has vanished to become her own. A French butcher blade hangs in my house as a token. I remember this knife as it carves its message into my sleeping. She only read its warning written upon my face.
You are listening to the Lesbian Radio Show over WBAI in New York City. The poet is Audre Lorde, black lesbian feminist activist.
The Cancer Journals came to be written as an attempt to break one silence, one aspect of the kinds of silences that we partake of as women. But I was also thinking, as the announcements went on, of Sarah mentioned Botha's visit here. It was not the Prime Minister, it was his brother who was the Foreign Minister. It's about keeping it in the family, but it's pretty much the same. This has been in the wind for weeks, and I wonder how many of you agree, think it's fine, think it's wonderful that even now the policy of this country, which at least on paper was not accepting or underwriting apartheid in South Africa, is now in the process of being turned around, right? Do you know about it? How do you feel about it? How have you made your feelings known? Even a postcard, right, to Washington, that this is not acceptable, that South Africa is not to lie down with us, right? Or at least when it happens that there are people, there are voices in this country who resent it, who do not want this to happen. I mean, once we start thinking of ourselves as active people, once we realize that we have a power and that that power is relative, but that we have a responsibility, I have a responsibility to speak out about what I feel, about what I think, that each one of you do, then the climate, then the whole aura begins to change. It becomes not one of simply acceptance, right? What can we do about it? But a different stance, which is, I have a voice and I have to use it. So it's just something that I'd like you to keep in mind. When you hear announcements, when you recognize things are happening that you do not wish to happen, that it's not enough just to say, isn't that terrible? You have a responsibility to yourselves, to our lives. Please, I ask again, I would hope that whatever you get that you can use, that you use it, right? That you use it to help shape or in some way form our lives, your lives. The Cancer Journals, as I said, came to be written after my bout with breast cancer, after I became aware that I had it, and that is a continuing, it is a condition of life. And I looked around for some of the words that other women, other black, lesbian, feminist, poets perhaps had written, how do I handle this? And of course there was nothing, nothing. I thought, all right, there you go, Audrey, right, say it. So I thought, well, this is not every woman's story, this is not every woman's feeling, but I, for my own self, needed to break that silence, needed to set down some of the things I was feeling, some of the things that I thought, and just in terms of how did it happen? And this is how the Cancer Journals came into being. I moved from that to a real awareness of the ways in which cancer is a force within our lives, certainly must be a force within the lives of all American women, and why there is so much silence about it. In other words, the political implications of the silence about cancer, and specifically the political implications concerning the silence about breast cancer, and how this needs to be broken, and how we need to begin recognizing this and recognizing what fear does to us, right? That fear of cancer is what protects the silence, and of course the silence is what keeps us from coming together. I'm going to read some of the journals. Roughly, there's an introduction and three essays. The first was an essay which was written before I knew I had cancer at a scare. The second deals with the day-to-day occurrence and many of the things I felt, a lot of the journal entries, both before the mastectomy and right after it. And the third, Power versus Prosthesis, is a synthesis, really, of some of the information, research that I found out about, research that I did after I was writing this book, and also some of the connections about between cancer and our lives in general.